Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, let's get right back into the issues of the day as we continue with our program now that the election is over. Well, the election's sort of over. I mean, there's still... Today, Jeff Merkley declared victory in Oregon, so another Senate seat on the side of the Democrats. We'll see what happens with the Franken race in Minnesota. It looks like that's going to a recount. And, in fact, a little later on in the day, we may be discussing that topic as well. We'll see how this all shakes out today. Right now, Stephen Moore is on the line with us. He is the co-author of a new book, The End of Prosperity, How Higher Taxes Will Doom the Economy If We Let It Happen, along with Arthur Laffler and Peter Tenous. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom.
You know, I I should say, by the way, you were also the founder and president of the Club for Growth, the president from 1999 to 2004, and a member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal and a senior economics writer at the Journal. I'm astounded that you're trying to sell this stuff, Stephen. We saw this in the 1980s, all the promises from the Laffler curve, which you have a chapter about in your book, to Reaganomics and we're going to cut taxes. And the fact of the matter is that for average working people, it's done very well. It's done very well. It did very well for me during those years. And it's done very well for people who are making over $250,000, over $1 million. And there were some years where it did spectacularly well for me. But I was in those high income categories. For the average working person, though, I would say the economy that you guys promoted sucks.
Well, the last 25 years has been probably the most prosperous time in American history. If you just
not for working people,
sure it has. I mean, if you look at how, you know, if you look at the standard of living of the average American today versus 30 years ago, it's been dramatically increased. I mean, and that's not just my opinion. If you just look at the Census Bureau data,
strip the debt out of it, Stephen, that is absolutely wrong, and real wages are down.
Well, if you look at the net worth of the average household, it's almost doubled over the last 25 years. And that's, by the way, the net worth is their assets minus their debts. But I think there's no question we're in a big economic hole right now. But I'm just talking about that.
As a result of Reaganomics.
Wait a minute, you're going to blame the problem that we have now on what Reagan did 26 years ago?
Yes, because we have been living in that era for 26 years. I think that we need to roll back the Reagan tax cuts. The economy was doing very well, thank you much. In the 1960s, we had annual growth of around 4.5%. In the 80s, that you're so fond of, it was only 3.6%.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, 3.6%. Here's the economy grew at much more slowly in the 80s than during the 60s. The post-war average was 3.6 growth, no faster than in the 1970s and the 1980s. Rate of job growth was lower than in the 60s or the 70s during your beloved 80s. Mm-hmm. Unemployment rates were high, 5.2% by 89, well above the 3.5 and 4.1% rates achieved at the end of the 60s and the 90s booms. Investors made out during the 80s, but workers lost. I mean, today, real average earnings of non-supervisory workers are below those of 30 years ago.
Tom, will you do me one favor and read the book? I mean, I'm serious, because if you look at the book, I mean, we have a lot of the data on what happened with the economy. You're right. The 60s was a great period of growth, and John F. Kennedy ran as a tax cutter against the sort of the economically staid Nixon and Eisenhower policies. People forget that the first Reaganite or supply-sider was John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy ran for office on a big income tax rate reduction, which cut the top income tax rate from 90% to 70%. And it was, in fact, Ronald Reagan modeled his program after what John F. Kennedy had done. And if you look at what happened with the tax revenues in the 1960s, they exploded after Kennedy cut taxes.
I'm sorry, that's just not true. Kennedy made it very clear that his family was paying that so-called 90% rate, and none of them were even paying 70%. He proposed tax changes, which he said would increase revenues, which would balance the budget, and he called them tax changes, and in other places he called them a tax increase. He lowered the top marginal rate from 90% more or less to 70% more or less, yes, but he closed loopholes, and he bragged about the fact that he was going to close the loopholes to increase revenues.
And he you're right, he cut the top rate from 90 to 70, and then the other thing that he did was he cut the capital gains tax in half, which was a big deal in terms of, you know, promoting growth. So my only point is that you've had three periods of really very strong economic growth in the last 40 years, the 60s, the 80s, and then in the 90s. And in those periods, we kept taxes low. We actually had a big increase in the tax payments by the rich. And our challenge as a country is not to have a tax system that makes rich people poor, but a tax system that makes poor people rich. And sometimes
nobody is suggesting that the rich people even could become poor under any of these tax systems. Well, nobody's promoting Marxism. We're not going to, you know, do what happened to Ayn Rand's father. But this is Jack Kennedy in the debate with Richard Nixon. You tell me that he's talking about reducing taxes.
Third, I think it's possible to gain $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
And then he continued to talk about how repeatedly Nixon and other conservatives were arguing that he was calling for a tax cut when, in fact, he was calling for a tax increase,
and he was disappointed
that people would distort his record.
Well, Tom, look,
you
talk about what he said in the 1960 election.
So in my judgment, this is what he said. We would spend more money in this administration on aid to education, we'd spend more money on housing, we'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. But I believe that the next administration should work for a balanced budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
And I'm horrified when I hear guys like you, Stephen Moore, and other conservatives and neoconservatives, economic neoconservatives, trying to stand on Jack Kennedy and distorting his record.
Well, I mean, it is a fact of historical record that John F. Kennedy proposed the largest tax cut in 50 years.
It was a tax increase.
It was
a tax rate cut, but he closed so many loopholes that it increased revenue. It didn't increase revenue because all of a sudden people were making more money. It increased revenue because tax receipts went up.
It did. You're right. It was the greatest supply side experiment ever, and it worked.
It had nothing to do with supply side. It had to do with closing loopholes.
No, but look, I'm in favor of closing loopholes. I mean,
you want to increase taxes.
I want a flat tax. We get rid of all the loopholes. Every loophole in the tax system I'd be in favor of getting rid of. Every single one of them. I don't think we should have a single tax deduction or carve out or credit or anything. I want to get rid of it all. I want to get the top tax rate down to 18, 19, 20% with no deduction so everybody pays their fair share.
So you think that people should not be able to deduct the cost of their home mortgage interest, for example?
I think if you offered the American people a simple flat rate tax system on a postcard with an 18% rate, they'd gladly give away all their deductions. I mean, you can't have it both ways. You can't say you want to broaden the base and get rid of the loopholes and then be against a flat tax.
So you're saying to me that the 40% of Americans, as John McCain pointed out,
yep,
who, as a consequence of Reaganomics, are making so little money right now that they're paying, substantial payroll taxes, they're paying substantial sales taxes, they're paying substantial property taxes, but they happen not to be paying federal income tax,
mm-hmm,
that those people should start paying 17% federal income tax and they would embrace that? Is that
what you're saying? I want to see people making more money so they can pay more taxes.
So you're going to call for an increase in the federal minimum wage?
No, I want to make more jobs and higher incomes. You don't raise incomes. All you do by raising the minimum wage, you destroy jobs. I want to create jobs that are high paying jobs. And the way to do that is to have healthy businesses that are investing in America. And you can do that through a low rate tax system. I mean, Tom, do you think that it's pro-American to have a corporate income tax system where we've got the second highest corporate income tax in the world?
Well, the fact of the matter is, Stephen, again, you're misrepresenting it. We are the, in terms of tax, federal tax receipts, we are the third lowest in the industrialized world. As Warren Buffett said in his preface to the Berkshire Hathaway annual report last year, quote, Corporate taxes are at the lowest level in the United States since 1934, representing 7.4% of all federal tax receipts, down from 32% of all federal tax receipts in 1952.
Tom, we're saying
we have the third lowest actual paid income taxes in the world.
Exactly. We have the world's the worst of all worlds.
That's
we
not
have
what you just said.
We have the worst of all worlds. We have a high corporate income tax rate, the second highest in the world, that doesn't raise any money. So why don't we cut the corporate tax rate to, you know, you talk about these Benedict Arnold companies that are leaving America and going offshore. One of the reasons they do that is to get away from our high corporate
tax
rate.
No, they do that because we, unlike most countries, ever since Reagan, we have torn down the barriers that protect our country. We've taken down tariffs, we've taken down domestic content laws, we've changed the tax code so that corporations can offshore their jobs. We actually promote
that. I want to bring that capital back into the U.S., and one way of being a magnet for that is to cut the corporate rate and to cut the income tax. But look back at John F. Kennedy's record. He was a supply sider. He cut the top tax rate.
I'm sorry, you're not going to reinvent John Kennedy for me, Stephen Moore. Stephen Moore, the book is The End of Prosperity, How Higher Taxes Will Doom the Economy If We Let It Happen, with Lafler and Tanous. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Hours, 9 minutes and 17 seconds till Barack Obama takes the oath of office. The Tom Hartman Program here, brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting our show, supporting your radio station, supporting our advertisers. Let them know you're listening, please. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room, airamerica.com for our free live streaming video, free audio, free chat room, free message board. It's all there. It's all there at airamerica.com and at tomhartman.com. Actually, two different message boards. Your choice. Lots of options. I heard a talk show host yesterday make one of the most asinine statements I think I've ever heard. He said words to the effect of, if you want to know what the world thinks of Barack Obama, look at the stock market. I'm sorry. If you want to know what the world thinks, if you want to know what the consequences of 26 years of Reaganomics are, look at the stock market. The market falling is not an indication of the world being unhappy with Barack Obama. The market falling is the result of 26 years of Lafler curve, Reaganomics, voodoo economics, as George Bush Sr. called it, of this idea that If we cut taxes on the wealthy, and if we cut taxes on corporations, and even though they're continuing to use the commons in disproportionate amount, consequence, and we have the middle class and working people pay for all the cost of those commons, or we simply ignore the commons so bridges fall down and schools fall apart and water supplies are not safe, and our food isn't tested, and our drugs are being outsourced to China where we can't even be sure that, and on and on and on. Let's just destroy the commons. That if we do that, somehow it's going to bring prosperity. It doesn't. What it's bringing is a crashing and burning of our economic system, of the stock markets around the world. And I'm telling you, it's just the beginning. You ain't seen nothing yet. You ain't seen nothing yet. Look at all the businesses around the United States right now that is the result of 26 years of Reaganomics, punctuated by a brief couple years of Clintonomics, but by and large, 26 years of Reaganomics destroying, ripping apart the middle class of this country, while the wealthy are doing very well. Thank you very much. And I'm telling you, now that Obama is president, you are going to hear this thing on steroids. I am hearing supposed news commentators, people like Tom Brokaw, talking about, oh, this is a center-right nation. Yeah, right. Center-right. Over 70% of Americans want Social Security strengthened. Over 80% of Americans want national health care. The vast majority, well over 70% of Americans believe that progressive taxation should be increased, not decreased. I'm saying, let's not just roll back the Clinton tax cuts, at least on the wealthy. Let's roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Let's go back to the tax system we had under John Kennedy and have the kind of prosperity that we had in the 60s and the 70s. And you say, well, there was a recession toward the end of the 70s, Jimmy Carter. Yeah, it was. It was the result of both LBJ and Nixon having a war and paying for it on credit. And the bill came due in the 70s. We've been having a war now for the last 6 years. We've been paying for it on credit. That bill's going to come due, too. And it's going to be tough. And I guarantee you that the cons are going to be out there going, see, this is all Obama's fault. This is all the Democrats' fault. No, it's not. It is the consequence of 26 years of Reaganomics, and it must be reversed. David in Granby, Massachusetts, listening on WHMP. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. It's good to talk to you. I wanted to make this point even before I knew who your guest was going to be. I've heard a lot of McCain supporters talking about how they don't believe Obama and they're worrying about creeping socialism and wealth redistributing and all that. I'd just like to offer a quick piece of electoral map trivia, and you can make of it what you will. With the exception of Texas, every state that went for McCain in the Electoral College is a state whose citizens receive more money from the federal government than they pay in taxes.
Right.
So I think, you know, those people need to start looking at themselves first before they start worrying about Obama redistributing wealth.
Yeah, here are the actual, you know, some of the actual numbers. Mississippi, for every dollar that they pay in federal taxes, they get $2.02. Alaska, for every dollar they pay, they get $1.84. Louisiana, for every dollar they pay, they get $1.78. West Virginia, for every dollar they pay, they get $1.76. North Dakota, for every dollar they pay, they get $1.68. Alabama, for every dollar in federal money they pay, they get back from the federal government $1.66. On the other hand, flip it around, New Jersey, for every dollar they pay, they get 61 cents back. Connecticut gets 69 cents back. Minnesota gets 72 cents back. Illinois gets 75 cents back. California gets 78 cents back. New York gets 79 cents. Massachusetts gets 82 cents. Wisconsin gets 86 cents. Bottom line, the blue states are getting screwed in the money that they're sending off to Washington, D.C., and the red states are getting welfare, and they have the audacity to talk about socialism? Come on! Very well said, David. Thank you very much. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com, our website. AirAmerica.com for our live video stream. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. No, it doesn't lead to stiff thinking. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Ben Franklin, if you would be wealthy, think of saving as well as getting. Nice quote. Our poem for the day. The election is over. The results are now known. The will of the people has clearly been shown. Let bygones be bygones. Let bitterness pass. I'll hug your elephant and you kiss my donkey. Indeed. Oh, it's a Higgins alert. Well, it's a Animal Alert. A soup kitchen exclusively for dogs and cats has opened its doors in Berlin, providing pets of the homeless and unemployed with a free meal, the director of the establishment said on Friday. People underestimate dogs, he said. They're incredibly important for those who lack social contact with other humans. Yes, and cats, too. The problem I have is if we tried to take Higgins to a soup kitchen or any place else, he would eat anybody who got within range. It would not be safe for other humans. Rich in Detroit. Hey, Rich, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thanks, Tom. I appreciate it. Hey, say, we're a fellow Whittle alumni.
Oh, yeah? You worked at WITL?
Wow. Yeah, I think we must have just missed each other. I started, gosh, I think it was like late 77, working for Dwayne Stacker in the news department.
Oh, yeah, after Bob Brakeman had left.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, yeah. So I'll shoot you an email and I'll get you
on stuff. Yeah, I worked on and off at Whittle for 10 years.
I'm sorry?
I worked on and off at Whittle for 10 years.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, yeah. Well, see, I was still a student at Michigan State, and I got like a midday part-time kind of gig there, and that's, you know, so.
That's how I started in radio in 68.
Yeah.
I was 17.
Same.
So anyway, Rich, what'd you call about?
Well, I called about, Tom, I've heard you talk about Kennedy's tax cuts, and the guest you just had on was talking about how JFK cut taxes, a supply Saturn. I've heard it so much that a couple of years ago, I sent an email to the JFK Library, and I actually got a response back from a researcher there. I had asked for the details on JFK's tax cuts, and the response was, I can't quote it exactly, but it was essentially, unfortunately, President Kennedy died before any tax legislation was passed.
That's true. It was signed by LBJ in early 64.
Well, yeah, I don't know that that was JFK's bill, though, and I'll tell you why, because he didn't refer me to a specific piece of legislation or pieces of legislation, but rather to a speech that President Kennedy made before the American Society of Newspaper Editors. That was the famous speech where he said a rising tide lifts all boats.
Right.
So I'm not sure that JFK even sent legislation to Congress to change taxes. And you know, like I said, I just hear it repeated over and over again, and I just wanted to set the record straight as far as history is concerned.
Excellent. Rich, thank you so much.
You bet, Tom.
I appreciate that. And sure. Great to hear another old Whittle guy.
It's good. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And in fact, here's John Kennedy just speaking about why he's proud to be a liberal as opposed to a supply sider.
Opponents mean.
There we go.
What do our opponents mean when they apply to us the label liberal? If by liberal they mean, as they want people to believe, someone who is soft in his policies abroad, who is against local government, and who is unconcerned with the taxpayer's dollar, then the record of this party and its members demonstrate that we are not that kind of liberal.
They just make it up.
But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead.
That's us.
And not behind. Someone who welcomes new ideas.
That's us.
Without rigid reactions. Someone who cares about the welfare of the people.
That's us.
Their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties.
That's us.
Someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad. If that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
There you go. John Kennedy accepting the endorsement of the Liberal Party in New York back in 1960. Boy, how things changed. Mike, and how they say the stay the same. Mike in Binghamton, New York. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you for calling. What's up?
I was calling in response to your first guest because he seemed appalled at the notion that the recent collapse of the market had anything to do with Reaganomics. I wanted to see what you thought or how much of an impact you think that the deregulation of the market during the 80s had to do with the recent collapse of the market and ask how effective you think Barack Obama is going to be to fix our economics in the country right now.
With regard to Obama, we're going to have to wait and see. I'm not prejudging him. I'm certainly not organizing a circular firing squad or anything like that, you know, as Democrats so often do. You know, I think that we need to, you know, he's got 74 days before he even takes office. And then, you know, let's cut him some slack for a while and see what happens. I think that he's going to be a very, very good president. I think he's going to bring a lot of very good people in. And so I'm not going to pre-criticize or pre-praise other than to say, you know, thank God that we've got a man of integrity and a Democrat as president.
Agreed.
With regard to what caused the stock market crash, I think that there are three things that have achieved a confluence. I've talked about this before on the show. Strauss and Howe wrote a brilliant book called The Fourth Turning back in the mid-1990s. They published this book. And they pointed out that roughly every 80 years we have a major economic depression. and it's typically followed by a war. And that it's in part arguably because it takes that long for the people who remember what caused the previous depression to die off. And in part, they, you know, they suggest that there are these four generations. A generation is about 20 years. Jefferson defined a generation as 19 years, but basically about 20 years. The first generation has the experience of the Great Depression. They're followed by a generation of slow and quiet, careful builders of the economy and the country. They're followed by a generation that rejects the quiet, careful buildingness and seeks spiritual enlightenment and questions authority. And they're followed by a generation that says, who cares about spiritual stuff and who cares about fighting the man? Let's just get rich. And the excesses of that generation, the let's just get rich generation, causes another depression, which causes the, you know, the fifth generation again to experience depression. So every 80 years, with, you know, the last one was 80 years ago in 1930s, 80 years before that was the depression of the 1860s, 80 years before that was the depression of the 1770s, that led to the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, and World War II, arguably. So, there's that, number one. Number two, you've got all the massive deregulation of Reagan. Now, this is also cyclical. Back in the 1920s, there were seven major tax cuts in the 1920s for people who were, for the rich, basically. You know, cutting back on the income taxes that had been put in place in World War I and cutting back majorly on corporate taxes also that in large part had been put in place, some of them going back to Reconstruction, many of them from World War I. And these tax cuts led to this enormous concentration of wealth, which we are seeing now. We're again at the point where wealth has been concentrated to where it was in the late 20s. And that produces incredible instability in the marketplace. And then third, the lack of regulation. We have now, our markets, which should be an opportunity for people to invest in productive businesses and share in the wealth of that productivity, have instead become gambling casinos. And that's, again, exactly what happened in the 1920s, and it's exactly what happened in the 1850s. And arguably, it's what happened in the 1760s, although I think that that analogy is a little more imperfect. So, Mike, those are the three things that I'd say, you know, brought it about, and we're seeing them all over again. And then you get people running around saying, oh, Reaganomics is wonderful, or this or that, or we saw a bump here, we saw a drop here. If you look at the business cycles, if you look at the growth, the economy has pretty much, you know, there are a few years where it fell back for a year or so. But other than the Great Depression, other than the panic of the 1896, other than the Depression of the 1860s, I mean, there have been a few times when the GDP actually shrank for several years in a row. But by and large, every year the economy grows. Tax policy has not affected the economy growing. Tax policy has not affected the business cycles. What it has done, Reaganomics, what it has done is it has shifted wealth from the working class to the rich, period. I mean, that's just the bottom line. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Tom, I think another way that you could describe it, and Ralph Nader's done it very elegantly, is in the 50s, when arguably many scholars could conclude that we had the most homogenous middle class because we had the most unions, mm-hmm. the top 40% controlled and owned roughly 95% of all the wealth. And then we had the Reaganomics and the deregulation and the cutting of the income tax, corporate and personal, and a massive consolidation of the wealth. And now it's the top 10% own and control 95% of all the wealth. And you ask yourself, Tom, where's the trickle? There is no trickle. And there never was in the history because the rich and the families, they don't pass that wealth on trickling and spending it out in the economy. They consolidate the wealth, and that's egregious to the better economic good of the masses out here, especially the working class.
Yeah. You know, the case.
And I think it's, Tom, let me wrap this up. I think that the top 10%, I think the reason, okay, they own 95% of the wealth and it's not trickling. They're hoarding it and they want more. And I don't think it's because they were taxed, too much. I think it's because everything's based on incentives. They were taxed too little.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think that we all,
that's why we need to roll back the Reagan tax cuts, Armin. I spot on. I agree. And let us remember that the cake that Marie Antoinette was talking about, that was the word that referred to the stuff that falls off the edge of a bread pan when you're baking bread. You know, the stuff that, the kind of little bit of surplus, the stuff that from the bread rising that falls on the, it was basically let them eat scraps was what she was saying. Not let them eat cake. At least that's my understanding of it. And that's trickle-down economics. You know, I love the pun. I mean, it's a terrible pun, but trickle-down economics produces nothing other than a nation of peons.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Helping you win the water cooler war is the Tom Hartman radio program here, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Downright strange. Your astrological sign may not be what you think it is. This is from Live Science. Great conversation starter. What's your sign? Well, turns out over the last couple thousand years, because of this 25,800-year cycle called precession, that the Earth has moved somewhat relative to the astrological signs, and there's a scientist out there, an astrologer, suggesting that we need to recalculate them. That, for example, Taurus, which is my sign, really should be April 18 to May 13, rather than what it currently is. Everybody's sign needs to be shifted a few days. Uh-oh, it's going to screw up a lot of conversations in bars, if nothing else. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Tim in Detroit. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, just to kind of riff on that last thing you just said, there actually now have been discovered 13 constellations, not 12 anymore.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, yeah. You know, a lot of indigenous people use 13 because there's 13 lunar cycles every year, 13 months, and as I recall, if I'm remembering.
Yes. And we all know constellations are just basically patterns that we see in the sky anyway. They don't inherently exist.
Yeah.
But I wanted to talk about Reaganomics real quick. Based on something, and you touched upon earlier, called the Laffler curve.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of an absurd curve. What it assumes, it basically says that as you lower marginal rates, you actually tend to increase revenue and therefore generate economic jobs. But what happens is you create much more deficits, and the job growth actually slows very much downhill because it assumes the capital is generated by investment rather than labor. We have to go back to the labor model of economics.
Yes, absolutely. And the other problem is, over the short term, it may work. It may provide an artificial stimulus to the economy by keeping more dollars in circulation, although you could argue that in a non-war economy, it keeps more dollars in circulation. In a war economy, which we've had basically since the 1950s, those dollars that come out of circulation that go into the military, many of them don't go back into the economy. They're made into bombers and bombs and nuclear weapons and things that don't get used, or when they do, they get destroyed. But but it may produce some small short-term stimulation, but that is massively overset over the long term by the cost of servicing the debt.
And of course, during Reagan, he had a lot of defense spending too that increased and may have created certain bubbles that ultimately busted as well.
Yep, absolutely. Well said, Tim. Thank you very much, Robert in Clifton, Tennessee. Hey, Robert.
Hello, Tom. Say, I've been listening to you talk about tariffs for 3 or 4 years now, and I think you're leaving out a very important component. Tariffs can, of course, as you have, be described as revenue, but we can also talk about the quality of the goods. Mm-hmm. The thing that affords saleability of an imported good would be innovation, improvement, something that makes the product worthwhile. And I think that tariffs drive improvement of quality.
How so?
Well, if someone is making a product that's selling air and someone in a foreign country invents an improvement, they may be able to pay the tariff and still garner market share.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly how Sony got a toehold in the U.S. market with the transistor radios back in the 60s.
Yes. And
even though the transistor was invented here in the United States.
And all across the economy, we can see that improvements in products make it worthwhile to import them.
Yeah, excellent point, Robert. Excellent point, and well said. Thank you very much. Yeah, it's not, you know, tariffs aren't a cure-all or anything like that, and there's always going to be a very, very dynamic side to international trade. I'm totally in favor of international trade. I just, as was Alexander Hamilton in 1791 when he presented his paper on manufacturers to the U.S. Congress, arguing for a roughly 30% tariff across the board, and got it, by the way, and got it for the next 200 years. The point that I make is that we need to have rational tariffs. We need to have reasonable tariffs. We need to have tariffs that protect labor, basically. And we need to, as the caller before you said, we need to go back to a labor value model of the economy rather than an investment value model-based model of the economy. Because investment, you know, you can build a factory to make something. But if nobody's buying that something, that factory is going to run for, what, 6 months before you shut the doors? I mean, it's going to go away. You've got to have customers. So and those customers are people who have money in their pocket because they have a decent job. So, you know, demand is created by jobs, period. It's very, very simple. Tupac in Phoenix, Arizona, listening to KPHX. Hey, Tupac, you want to talk about the new Obama administration?
Good morning, Tom. No, I just want to give the listeners a heads up. We've discussed this on your program before regarding the message that is heading towards the new administration of President Obama from the indigenous peoples of this continent, related to the adoption of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which was adopted last September the 13th in 2007 by the UN General Assembly. And, you know, we've discussed about possibly having some program on your show regarding this, being the fact that it was the Anglophile governments, U.S., Canada, New Zealand and Australia, that were the main obstacles to having that declaration adopted at the UN.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the message is that as the surviving indigenous nations of the continent of the Americas, which we call in our own terminology Avyayala, we have a rendezvous with history in terms of the continents, that we have finally completed the circle with an African-American president here in North America.
Mm-hmm.
We remember Vicente Guerrero, who was an African-American president in Mexico over a century ago, not to mention Toussaint Louverture in the Caribbean. African-American presidents are a newer thing, but it's a good thing that the U.S. is finally catching up.
Yeah, look at Evo Morales as well.
Evo Morales, there's another evidence. So we need to get, with all this euphoria which or this optimism, we really need to also put it into measure. In terms of the international geopolitical strategies, we need to call for the end of colonization and genocide of indigenous peoples in this hemisphere.
Absolutely. Not just this hemisphere, Tupac.
All over the world. And if I have one more minute, I would also add that it's a good opportunity along the same trajectory to unite the logic of economic development with ecological sustainability.
Yes, well said. Dennis Weaver was the guy who invented the word ecolonomics. And there's a university that is teaching ecolonomics, Dennis Weaver's invention, and the intersection of economics and ecology. I think it's very, very important. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, continuing on the notion of the difference between conservative and liberal worldviews, here's a question for you. And this, you know, it may seem frivolous, but I think it's an example of how, you know, the free market, not always exactly working, sometimes. So-called potty parity for men's and women's restroom will be on the agenda at the 8th Annual World Toilet Summit and Expo, sent to commence in Macau today. The summit, organized by the World Toilet Organization, WTO, I'm sorry, will bring a... This has got to be. This is strange news by the Live Science staff. I actually don't know if this is a parody or not. The first of these initiatives, potty parody, will be debated at the event. Summit's three-day agenda will focus on tackling the sanitation challenges of the world, including promoting clean toilets in poor areas, as well as improving hygiene standards in developing countries such as China and India. I guess the question, though, that came to my mind was, should we mandate? I mean, is this really too much big government? That because women typically spend more time in the bathroom and yeah, I've seen, you know, events where the line at the women's room is huge and the men's room, you know, is in and out very quickly. Should there be more stalls? Should they be larger or not? So that's just, you know, one of those things where a question I could argue either side of that, frankly. But I think that for public facilities, particularly sports facilities and things like that, it just seems like there's a real disparity and that it hasn't been responded to appropriately over the years. On a more serious note, I received an email from Marty who says, dear Mr. Hartman, I'm reaching out this morning to everyone in an attempt to understand what happened in California with the passage of Prop 8 and what I/we can do to stop this travesty. My partner and I have been together for 13 years, proudly married on October 19th. With the passage of Prop 8, our marriage is in jeopardy. This is wrong on so many levels. How does our state constitution get changed with a simple majority rather than a two-thirds majority? Why is there no enforcement of the separation of church and state? How did the Catholic and Mormon churches get away with spending millions of dollars on our state to pass this proposition? The majority of the money was coming into our state from outside California. Is this legal? Let me just, and what do we do? And then she goes on to say, the irony in the election is that for the first time we elected a black man. I've worked for equal protection and civil rights my whole life. I walked, marched proudly down the streets of Biloxi, Mississippi in the 60s, and have always supported equal rights for all. Well, there's a whole bunch of issues that come up around this. The first is, I heard this morning on NPR, they interviewed an African-American pastor who was characterized as the pastor of one of the largest African-American congregations in all of California. And he talked about how he was mobilizing, had successfully mobilized his church for yes on Prop 8. In other words, to amend the California Constitution to outlaw gay marriage. And this was the, you know, several of my gay friends have commented over the last few weeks of the tragic irony, particularly in California, of this, that the largely, in fact, almost exclusively Catholic Hispanic population and the largely homophobic African-American population is coming out in large numbers to vote for Barack Obama, and they would probably vote yes on Prop 8. That was the concern, and that's apparently what happened. And, you know, I heard this minister say, you know, I'm a pastor of the Bible, and the Bible tells me that marriage is between a man and a woman. Well, the Bible also says, including the New Testament, by the way, that slavery is acceptable. In fact, Paul, you know, suggests that people should treat their slaves well. I mean, there are instructions on slavery in the Bible. In the Bible, it talks about stoning people, killing people, if they commit adultery, or if they speak back to their elders, or if they break any of the other Ten Commandments, or many of the other 600-plus commandments in Leviticus. If they eat shellfish, it's an abomination. I mean, it's actually higher on the list than a man sleeping with a man. Masturbation is something to be punished. Just because something is in the Bible doesn't mean it should be law, number one, and certainly doesn't mean it should be enshrined in the California Constitution. I think this is a real tragedy. In answer to direct answer to some of Marty's questions, number one, the amendment to the California Constitution with a simple majority rather than a two-thirds majority is a failure of the California Constitution. We have a problem like that here in Oregon as well. The progressive movement of the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, 1910s, and 1910s was very successful, particularly out here on the West Coast, but was successful in many parts of the United States, fusion voting in New York being one of the examples. We talked about Katrina Vandenhoevel with her about this a couple of days ago, and she helped correct a misperception that I had even of fusion voting. These were the result of the system having become so corrupted by massive transfers of wealth during Reconstruction, well, actually largely during the Civil War. Much of it happened, Abraham Lincoln giving massive amounts of free land to the railroads and huge amounts of money so that the railroads could build like crazy so that they could get war material to the soldiers fighting the Civil War. And then, you know, once the railroads were on that gravy train where they were receiving hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer dollars, once the railroads were on that gravy train, it just kept on going. Throughout the 1880s, the 1890s, the 1900s. And there was an incredible pushback. And it wasn't just the railroads. You know, John D. Rockefeller and the Standard Oil Trust, after the first oil well was drilled in Titusville, Pennsylvania, and all across Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, there were all these oil wells. And all the way out to the Midwest, into Ohio and Michigan, where I grew up, there I had friends who had farms with capped oil wells on them because they dried out back in the 1950s and 60s. In some cases, the 1940s. And so the progressive movement pushed really hard to make it possible for people to change legislation because the legislators had all been bought out. They had all been corrupted. Keep in mind, we didn't even directly elect the U.S. Senate until either 1919 or 1920. It's either the 19th or 20th Amendment, and it was in one or the other of those years, and I mix them up, but it was right in that era there. And so there was this incredible concentration of power in the hands of professional politicians, and the pushback to that was by the people. And what we are left with is this, what's called an initiative process or a ballot proposal proposition process in various states, where it's possible for somebody, and we just, every 2 years here in Oregon, we deal with this. We've got a couple of guys in this state, Kevin Mannix and Bill Sizemore. Bill Sizemore was actually even convicted of racketeering around this, who make a living, to a large extent, bringing money in from out of state, in particular from this guy, Lauren Parks, this sexual hypnotist who lives in Las Vegas, and a guy named Rich, a big real estate developer in Chicago, bringing in money from right-wing causes. This is a relatively small state. It's a relatively inexpensive state in terms of media, so a lot of right-wing things get tested here, a lot of ballot proposals, and then if they work here, they get rolled out all across the country. And they make a living putting these things on the ballot. And it's just a huge hassle for us. And frankly, I think that California, Oregon, and the other state, I think that there's 16 states, I'm not sure, but it's in the teens. The number, as I recall, the number of states that have the ability of citizen-based initiatives, yeah, it's a good thing, but there needs to be some limits on it. There needs to be some restraints on it. We need to say, particularly now that we directly elect the Senate and that we have better communication and our state legislators are more answerable to we the people. Frankly, I think that in states like Oregon and California, we should, you know, if you want to put something on the ballot for 2 years from now for the next ballot initiative, put something on the ballot that says a ballot initiative can only be put on the ballot. A, it must require 2/3 of the vote to pass, particularly if it's a constitutional amendment. B, it's a crime to make a living putting ballot initiatives on the ballot. C, it's a crime to pay anybody for signatures to put something on a ballot. And it's a crime to be paid. Now, here in Oregon, we passed the law saying you couldn't pay per signature. You shouldn't be able to pay at all. This should be, you know, the ballot initiative should be left for mobilized citizens. That was the original intent. We need to go back to that. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Fire it up when we fix the car.
It's the No Boring Zone, 21 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, J.R. in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, J.R., what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, J.R., you're on the air.
Hey, you know, I wanted to talk about the difference between conservatism and liberalism.
Yeah.
And I think the bigger question is how has Republican Party actually differed from the Republican philosophy of Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln? I mean, they run things more like a corporate-sponsored communist party more than they do, you know, the ideology of Abraham Lincoln and Roosevelt.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, J.R., and they took that route in the 1880s, you know, when they sold out to the big corporations. Teddy Roosevelt tried to bring the Republican Party back to their Lincoln roots. He was unsuccessful. He ended up leaving the Republican Party and running as a third-party candidate, the Bull Moose Party, and, you know, screwing up an election, as so often happens with third-party candidates. But, no. Mike in San Francisco. Hey, Mike.
Yes, hi.
Mike? Whoop. I think when Mike took me off the speaker, he dropped the line. You might try calling back, Mike. Fred in Los Angeles. Hey, Fred.
Hey. You know, the concern that I have is to increase the decrease the segregation between the sexes and the genders. And in public restrooms you talked about,
mm-hmm.
You're talking about that, where there's, you know, there's such a great turnover demand for the facilities. I think that one way to make it more efficient and more social is to increase the unisex nature of it.
Yeah, well, I can tell you, I lived in Europe for a year, which is pretty loose. I mean, you drive down the streets and some of the turnoffs on the Autobahn, on the highway and things, you'll see literally. In fact, one time I saw an entire busload of guys just standing there peeing in the grass. It's not an uncommon thing to see all over Europe. People are pretty casual about nudity and you know whatnot, but they don't have unisex bathrooms. I don't think it's going to happen, but it's an interesting idea. Becky in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hey, Becky, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I heard you speaking about scripture a little while ago, and it fascinates me. There's a scripture that talks about in the Old Testament that talks about the leader taking a stand and watching while the opposition destroys themselves by infighting. And I think that that's what we just saw in this campaign. And I think what we need to see now is, like Obama called us to, let's work together. Let's do this all together. He's willing to lead us, but we have to follow with our conscience and with our knowledge.
I respectfully disagree, Becky, at least with the latter part of what you said. As I said, I'm not going to start the let's pick on Obama right now because he's not, you know, enough exactly the way I think that he should be, or, you know, et cetera. I'm not going to start that. I'm going to give the guy a chance. And the job of the president of the United States is not to lead the country and for us to follow. The job of the president of the United States is to represent the country and for us to tell him the direction that we want the country to go in. We don't elect leaders in the United States. The word leader does not appear anywhere in our Constitution, anywhere in the Declaration of Independence. And, in fact, you won't even find it used. Frankly, I don't recall it being used at all in Madison's notes from the Constitutional Convention. The word representative appears over and over and over again. Yeah.
Thank you so much for that education. That's really helpful.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for calling, Becky. Good to hear from you. That's the thing. I mean, we need to. Yes, I want to cut Obama some slack. You know, historic presidency and all that. No, I don't want him to see him go down the same road that Bill Clinton did, which is running as a progressive, although he didn't that much. I mean, he ran as a pretty moderate, but nonetheless. Clinton ran as a progressive and governed as a conservative, by and large, and I don't want to see that happen in the Obama administration. But I'm going to hold my fire. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to give him every benefit of the doubt and try in every way I can to help that presidency be a successful one. Mike in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Mike.
Yeah, hi. Good morning, Tom. A couple things. One on your initiative discussion about the California initiative process. One of my rules of thumb is that the person who has the most advertisement on TV is the person to vote against, because that's usually the energy companies, the insurance companies. So that's one quick rule of thumb, because we put on so many conflicting initiatives. But I think I think the idea of unpaid signature collectors is really a great one, and I think that's the way. But the main reason that I'm calling is to discuss the Proposition 8 and the marriage initiative. Number one, the interesting thing, I think, that is a little bit of irony in it, is that now straight people and transgender people, I believe, can legally marry in California. So I think that that's a wonderful, in one sense, that's a great advance now, that transgender people can legally marry here. And since it's only a man and a woman.
But Mike, I think the work we have to do. Let's just be blunt about this. The real work we have to do is to bring the African American community and the Latino community into the 21st century.
Absolutely.
These are people who have been discriminated against for centuries as a result of the accident of genetics. And we now know that being gay is an accident of genetics, or maybe a blessing of genetics, whatever you want to call it. I don't mean to put it in the
right.
But it is not a choice. This
right.
is not, people are not saying, gee, I think I'll be gay today.
Right.
It is, people are born this way. And,
right.
And what we have to do is reach out to people who have been born a different way and discriminated against as a result of it, and say to them, you know, you were discriminated against for hundreds of years because you were black, or because you were indigenous to North America, or because you were Latino, and you need to be realized that you're in solidarity with your gay brothers and sisters.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Bill O'Reilly Show, Fox News.
That there were these gaps in her knowledge. And I just want to rattle off a couple of the things that insiders say she just simply didn't know. There were real problems with basic civics, government structures, municipal, state, and federal government responsibilities. She didn't know the nations involved in the North American Free Trade Agreement, we're told. Those, of course, being the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. NAFTA, a major campaign issue, that would have been something of a deficit. We're told that she wasn't actually able to name all the countries in North America as part of that debate. And she didn't understand, McCain aides told me today, that Africa was a continent and not a country, and actually asked them, they argue, they say, if South Africa wasn't just part of the country as opposed to a country in the continent.
Yeah. So she gets back to Alaska and she is asked about this.
On the day after the election, there was blistering criticism of Palin. Fox News cited anonymous sources who said Palin did not know Africa was a continent when she was chosen for VP.
That's kind of a small, evidently bitter type of person who would anonymously charge something foolish like that, that I perhaps didn't know an answer to a question. So until I know who is talking about it, I won't have a comment on it.
Oh, those gotcha questions like, is Africa a country or a continent? Those gotcha questions like, what are the countries in North America? It's just tough stuff, you know? It's just tough stuff. 866-303-2270, our number. Robert in Hollywood, California. Hey, Robert.
Hey, it's North Hollywood.
North Hollywood.
I respect you to the max, and I'm as liberal as can be, with the exception of the gay marriage issue. You should know better than anybody else, because you understand even much more than I do the essence of culture, the essence of society, and that marriage is one of the foundations that was put in there eons ago and I think primarily to keep people responsible, to keep them from just going around doing whatever they want to do, that gives them more responsibility. If you change...
Robert, let me pause you right there for a second, if I may, and suggest to you that you are you're reciting the worldview of Thomas Hobbes, the core conservative worldview, that people are so evil and dysfunctional that they need to have external authority, external structures to prevent them from acting out their intrinsic evil or their intrinsic incompetence. And I would submit to you that A, people are not that bad. People actually can figure out how to have a relationship. I've been married to Louise for 36 years, not because the law requires me to, but you know, because it's worked out. I mean, you know, sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it does. But it's about people. It's not about laws, number one. And number two, that, if I may, that we have a pair of gay ducks behind our house for 3 years. These two male ducks have been together. They groom each other. They go everywhere together. They try to mate. We've watched them try to mate, or maybe they're succeeding. I don't know. It's hard to tell with a duck. It's a pretty exotic process, but, you know, one climbs on the other and dunks them underwater. It's pretty amazing. But in any case, this happens in nature. I'm telling you, I'm seeing it off my back porch. I live in a houseboat in a river.
Okay, let me make one point.
Sure.
Here's the point. If you accommodate for the gay issue where men and men and women, whatever, can get married, that's fine.
Right.
Because they love each other. Then you have to make the accommodation, because I'm sure that there are people out there, two men and one woman or two women and one man, that love each other as well. If you're going to go by the equality of accommodation, then you're going to have to accommodate marriage for three people. The possibilities are endless.
Why?
We
as a society...
If you're going to change the definition of marriage from being between a man and a woman, then why not change the definition of marriage between two people to three, to four, to five...
Well, is there a simple answer to it,
Robert? That's a ridiculous point.
No, there's a very simple answer to your question.
Nothing.
Is your question rhetorical or serious?
I'm serious.
Okay, well, let me give you a serious answer then. The majority of cultures in the world are actually polygamous. There are more polygamous cultures than there are monogamous cultures. The majority of people in the world live in societies that are monogamous, but the majority of cultures are polygamous. So, you know, there is polygamy out there, and it's been around for a long, long time. And as the members of the Mormon Church can tell you about that, but particularly the FSLD or whatever it is, FLDS. But polygamy is an adaptation to a society, to a war-based society. If you have a war-based society, if you have a society where it is normal that a large percentage of the men are going to be killed off, then you've got a huge imbalance between men and women, and polygamy starts to make sense from an anthropological point of view. We don't live in that kind of a society, and therefore I would submit to you that polygamy is, in a non-warfare nation or state or culture, is intrinsically unjust. It produces oppression of, by and large, of women.
Yeah, but Tom, if you have three people that love each other, if you are going to accommodate the change in definition of marriage between a man and a woman to two of the same, and you have three people that love each other just as much as two people of the same sex.
It's an apple and oranges argument, Robert.
Definition and change it to them as well, and to a point where it becomes ludicrous and the definition of marriage doesn't exist, and therefore people say, well, why should I even get married, because it doesn't mean anything.
What? Well, first of all, marriage in the religious sense is one thing, marriage in a legal sense is another thing.
I'm talking legality. I'm not talking religion. My religion sees marriage as being a legal thing, not as a religious thing, not as a holy thing. So I'm not coming from a religious standpoint.
So why would you – so are you a proponent of polygamy?
No, not at all. But if you change, then it will all
then because why does polygamy and why does the difference between polygamy and monogamy have anything to do with the difference between heterosexuality and homosexuality? I see them as completely different things, Robert.
We're talking about accommodation. If you accommodate for
no, we're not.
Dearly love each other from the same sex, and I have gay friends. I respect them. If you make that accommodation for two people of the same sex that love each other, then legally you have to make the accommodation for three people that love each other.
No, you don't.
As much as two people.
No, you don't.
Yeah, you do.
No, you don't. You simply say we don't live in a polygamous society. I'm sorry. We live in a monogamous society.
Equal
protection under the law. It doesn't matter what society we live in. If you make the accommodation, you change. All we're talking about is...
Well, under that logic, Robert, if you make the accommodation for two people who love each other, then you have to make the accommodation for three people who love each other, regardless of their gender.
But here's the point. If you change the legal definition of marriage, then there is no ending to the change. The only reason we are arguing this, I propose, is because of the political status of many homosexuals and their activity and their vocal activity and getting out in a political sense. I legally...
I'm sorry, Robert. That is such a homophobic statement. The reason why is because there are us among us. Robert, the argument that you're making is the argument that was made against miscegenation. It's the argument that was made against blacks and whites being married in the United States.
If we allow blacks and whites to get married,
pretty soon you're going to be allowing men and dogs to get married. I mean, that was Rick Santorum's logic.
The legal definition of marriage. I'm not talking about prejudice and denying things. People have the legal
You are
right
spouting prejudice, Robert. Let me just ask a couple of just simple questions here, okay?
Sure. Go ahead.
Do you think that because of the color of somebody's skin, they should be allowed to or not allowed to marry?
Of course not.
Why?
Because that's racial and we have equality. Man is man. It doesn't matter what race or what their color is. Next question.
Okay. So do you believe that all men who are born with male apparatus are actually wired in their brains as if they were men?
Not at all. That's fine. I do not see a difference between two men that love each other and sincerity of their love and the protection under the law for their relationship to be the same as a married relationship. All we're talking about is changing the legal definition of marriage.
So what you're arguing for is civil unions for gays, a separate but equal position, civil unions for gays and marriage for straights? Is that what you're suggesting?
If you want to, everybody has the, if they, they should have the legal right to own property, to adopt children, to visit each other in the hospital. But if you change the definition of marriage, then you are going to make it to a point where it becomes ridiculous and it has no more definition. Because legally, if you accommodate...
Only if you assume that you live in a society, Robert, that is widely embracing polygamy, and we don't. I mean, you might be able to make that argument in Egypt.
No. It doesn't matter, Tom, if we live in a society that many people are involved or not. Legally, if you accommodate...
Legally in Egypt, one man can have four wives.
Three people, Tom.
Legally in Somalia, five people can get married. Legally in Israel, the last time I was there, you could have an Arab husband could have up to four wives. Legally in many countries in the Middle East, you can have five people in a marriage. Polygamy is legal. Does that mean that they acknowledge gay marriage? They don't. These are two completely different issues.
Not at all. If you accommodate and change the definition of marriage, then you...
Robert, what you're suggesting, you know, three people who love each other is a completely different thing from somebody who is born being gay or being straight. It is a complete... You're talking apples and oranges.
We're talking about the definition of marriage.
We're not talking about a biological wiring. No, we're not. We're talking about being gay or straight.
What?
Robert, we're talking about being gay or straight. We're not talking about the definition of marriage. And the reason why this is so important, and the reason why civil unions will not work, and why civil unions would be a disaster for gays, and I lived in Vermont when we had civil unions, is because the word marriage is in thousands of laws all across this country. And if somebody is gay, they should have the same right to marry as somebody who is straight, period. That is not a choice to be gay. To have a relationship with five people, that's a choice.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
To be the one to say it was no good what we done. I dare a man to say I'm too young, for I'm going to try for the sun. We huddled in the derelict building, and when he thought I was asleep, He lay his poor coat round my shoulder and shivered there beside me in a heap. And who's going to be the one to say it was no good what we done? I dare a man to say I'm too young, for I'm going to try for the sun.
Place where smart people get their news. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We periodically try to feature our, we actually do it, feature advertisers who are having success on our radio station affiliates to demonstrate the value and effectiveness of Progressive Talk Radio in our format. And today, this week, our advertiser of the week, Joe Romano. He's the marketing director for Green Star Cooperative, greenstarcoop.com, Greenstar, GreenStarCoop.com, the website. And Joe advertises with Progressive Talk Radio in Ithaca, New York, our Ithaca affiliate, WNYY. Hey, Joe, welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Just great. Our format for this, Joe, is you get a minute to tell us about your product, and then I'd like to ask you for a minute about how advertising on WNYY is working out for you, and then we're going to go back to our callers. So tell us about your cooperative, about Green Star Co-op.
Sure. Well, we're a natural foods market. We're located in Ithaca, New York. And we have been here for 36 years. We started in, garages and basements, barrels of grain for sort of like a buying club. Mm-hmm. And we've grown into a $13 million natural foods co-op in our town.
That's wonderful. When Louise and I lived in Vermont, we were members of a local food co-op and bought all our food there. You could work in the co-op and get a discount for your food, or you could work in the co-op for pay. And as a member, at the end of the year, we'd get a check back sometimes. Is that how it works with you?
Yeah, exactly. We currently have a discount at the register for members, and we may be switching over. We're having a vote right now. That's another thing. Our members get a voice in how things happen here, so there's a vote to see how we distribute patronage.
Right. Co-ops are run as democracies, essentially. It's one of the wonderful
right.
things, as opposed to a traditional corporation, which is run as a kingdom.
We're
talking with Joe Romano. Pardon?
It's a very progressive movement.
It is. We're talking with Joe Romano, the marketing director for the Green Star Cooperative, greenstarcoop.com in Ithaca, New York, advertising on WNYY. Joe, how has WNYY done for you?
Well, they've done great. The listeners are progressive people, and we're part of a great progressive movement that has a really long history, and co-ops have always been right at the center of it. So it's a perfect match for us. We love all that's going on progressive radio, and our members do too. So they love hearing us on progressive radio.
Great. Joe, thanks so much. It's great to hear from you today, and
I wish
you the very best.
It's a great new day, too, isn't it, here in America? So
it is.
We're all glad to be part of it.
It truly is.
Thank you, Joe.
Joe Romano, greenstarcoop.com is the website. If you're in Ithaca, New York, if you're listening to our show there, get on over there and drop in. Thanks so much, Joe. Carl in Glendale, California. Hey, Carl, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how you doing, Tom? First of all, I want to tell you that you're terrific. I thank God for you and Randy. You guys are just, you're heaven sent to us,
Thank you.
But I wanted to talk about the homophobic thing in the African-American community. I'm an African-American man. I'm a straight man. And I feel so almost appalled that African Americans are still not aware of the fact that it has to do with civil liberties and so forth. And my grandson was hell bent on voting for that to kill Proposition 8. And I talked to him. So I finally told him, because I was interracially married. And I told him that when your grandmother and I got married, there were 17 states in this nation that if we had showed up in those states and had been found out that we were a married mixed couple, we could have gone to the penitentiary.
Yeah.
And I said, and then he started to think about it. But what really turned him around was, we were watching television one night, and lately I have not been a great fan of Dianne Feinstein, but she came on, her commercial came on. And the way she spoke about it was very clear. And the last thing that she said, and I'm paraphrasing because I can't remember the exact words she said, but it came down to, we cannot discriminate against people. We cannot start to take away people's civil rights and civil liberties. And that's what really changed his mind and had him vote against Proposition 8. So my point that I'm trying to make is that I feel that what needs to happen in the African-American and Latino community, but I'm speaking for my own community, the African-American community, is that we need to have these issues clearly stated, that in the sense that these are civil liberties. Because when you start taking one person's civil liberties away, as we all know, then it can be your turn in the barrel next. It can be your neighbor's turn in the barrel next. You know, it does not seem to stop. So what I would like to see, and I would be glad to be a part of any movement that we could get started in this area, to help African American people understand, it's not about what two adults do in the privacy of their own home that should matter to any of us. What should matter to us is that once you start discriminating against people because they are black or white or Latino or straight or homosexual or gay or whatever, it could get so bad that it could eventually end up being all left-handed people can't do this.
Actually, when my dad was a kid, left-handed children were their left hand was tied to their body, so they couldn't use it. And 500 years ago, left-handedness in Europe was seen as a sign of satanic possession, and left-handed children were very often put to death. So, Carl, you're absolutely right. And the whole Rick Santorum, it's going to lead to polygamy. It's going to lead to man on dog. Is nonsense. Polygamy is a choice. Man on dog is a choice. Being gay is not a choice. People are born that way. Just like being black is not a choice. Or being Latino is not a choice. Carl, so well said. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where progressives come to party. And Michael Harrison is on the line with us. He is the founder and publisher of Talkers Magazine. Talkers.com is the website. It is the industry publication for this business that I am in and that you are hearing right now. And also one of the most wise, I would say, observers of pop culture and the media. Michael, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
And you're also an old radio pro, as anybody can tell by listening to your voice. You've been around this business for a while.
With the operative word being old.
Aren't we both here? Michael, I'm curious your thoughts, and not just your thoughts, also as the sort of the spider at the center of this huge media web of talk radio. I mean, you hear from all sides of it, all dimensions of it. What are your thoughts on the significance of the election of Barack Obama for the nation, for the world, for the media, and for pop culture? I realize it's a pretty broad net to cast.
Well, it's a broad net to cast, but it's important that you look at the big picture to understand what it means to the smaller arena of our medium, talk radio, because this election is one of the most monumentally important and scene-changing events of our lifetime. This election, in my opinion, takes the whole playing board, the rules of the game, left versus right, Democrat Party principles versus Republican Party principles, the track records of politicians versus the track records of others. It takes it and it throws it out the window, if for nothing else but the symbolism of America electing an African-American man as president of the United States and him winning by such a significant majority of the vote, both in the popular and certainly in the electoral college. This sends a signal to the world that immediately changes the perception of the United States, which can change politics globally more than about anything else. Attitude is everything in politics and in international relations. And it's unleashed across the nation such positive emotions that even John McCain in his concession speech looked like he was getting it.
Yeah.
In terms of what was going on.
It was actually a very gracious speech.
Oh, very much so. It was his finest moment, and it was probably his most candid and honest moment in the campaign. Yeah. That being said, this presents talk radio and our set of media, talk television, internet, satellite talk, this whole arena that we're in, it makes it really a different game. We have to step back and look at how it affects our approach to things and how we position ourselves based upon gathering audiences and, even more importantly, having some kind of impact and some kind of cause.
Yeah, it does. And, in fact, yeah, coming back, I used this liner where progressives come to party. Frankly, I don't think I've said that in probably a year. Broadly speaking, we are... on this show, I mean, I have conservatives on every single day. We opened the show today with Stephen Moore, the founder of the Club for Growth. And it seems to me that America, that this old paradigm of are you on the left or or are you on the right is being replaced by a new paradigm of are you looking backward or are you looking forward?
And it always is that way. If you look at history, and great people of history, whether they're men or women, white or black, Americans or otherwise, history is always made, and the people historically that appear to be good guys were those that took their people or the human race as an entirety forward.
Right.
It wasn't the good ones and the bad ones. It's who took people forward. And that's why, you know, you should be very proud that you use the word progressive to describe what you do. We're not talking left or right. You could be progressive on the right. You could be progressive on the left.
Well, Teddy Roosevelt was.
You know, exactly. Sometimes progressive, we get so confused with these categories. But there's no historical record of any great human being coming along, being the man of the hour, who was reactionary.
Nobody. That's an excellent point. You know, I'd never considered that. You're absolutely right. Actually, you could argue that Adolf Hitler is the ultimate example of what happens when a reactionary becomes president. I mean, he came to power on the basis of fear and hatred, the hyperinflation and the fear of the other, demonizing Jews.
Exactly. So it's not so much, you know, sometimes you can get caught up in the danger of nationalism, the danger of political rallies, the danger of thousands of people waving flags. But you got to look at it more closely because that's part of the human experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's what is motivating those rallies? What is motivating that patriotism? What is motivating it? And the crowds that we saw the other night, the crowds across America and the overwhelming explosion of a different kind of patriotism is being motivated by the need for progress, not by the need to prove how powerful we are by our might, by our right, by how cool we are. It's more about let's have hope, let's try to get along, let's try to go forward. Now, it may prove to be naive and idealistic, and it might fall on its face. However, it might not, whereas the other way just wasn't working.
Yeah, well, and the other way has a more tragically predictable consequence. We're talking with Michael Harrison, the founder publisher of Talkers Magazine. When I started this talk show 6 years ago, one of the very first guys that I called up and said, "Tell me everything you know." Michael, you really have been such a mentor and friend to me all these years. I really appreciate it, and I want to acknowledge that. And I've you know what you just said just a minute ago. I mean, it seems like at least once a year, probably more often than that, I get some forehead slap aha from our conversations, and that was a great one. How do you think that this is going to affect the future of media in the United States? There's this, you know, one of the things, well, let me reframe that a little bit. 4 years ago, leading up to the election, one of the things that I tried not to do on my radio show was do all election all the time because of this thing called cum bleed, which is after the election, people who just go to a show because it's just about the election stop coming. And so we did this 4 years ago, we did it again this year, always every day dealt with issues larger than just who are you going to vote for, you know, on November 4th. And I'm wondering how many shows are going to be able to recover from that, particularly on cable TV. I mean, we see all these shows that just basically were entirely focused around the election. You know, what's the future of media here in this post-election
Well, first of all, there's going to continue to be news, there's going to continue to be challenges, and there are going to continue to be controversies. So I'm quite sure that all of these election central or your American election headquarters and all of that stuff will be replaced by whatever the heck the next big thing is,
and
these people will continue to be. And talk radio will continue to find things to talk about. Specifically, though, in terms of the left versus right, Democrat versus Republican paradigm that has just so dominated our thinking this past decade, if you will, and a program such as yourself, I would think we have to get back to what I talked about before, progressive and reactionary. And not progressive and reactionary as it applies to any one party, but rather to mindsets. Because right now, we face a couple of problems. One, we face America getting along in the world. We face dealing with an economic crisis of unprecedented proportion within our lifetime. And three, the real big problem we face is how do we change from dependency on oil to a new 21st century energy independent society here in the United States and around the world, which is one of your bailiwicks.
Yeah.
Progressive versus reactionary. And I think there'll be enough controversy. Should we have nuclear energy? Should we not have nuclear energy? Should we do solar? Should we do this? Should we do that? How do we fix the economy? How do we regulate Wall Street? What is the right amount of regulation so we don't become that terrible socialist state that the neocons are so petrified of, while having enough government regulation not to become a fascistic capitalistic state run by banks?
Yeah.
So these are the questions that we have to roll up our sleeves and deal with in talk radio. And I think it comes down to whether it's stupid talk radio or smart talk radio. And again, you know, throwing kudos at you, you really are a smart show. Unfortunately, prevailing conventional wisdom in commercial media is that smart things don't sell well. I disagree. We're in a time when everything is a niche. You don't have to, you know, have 50% of the public listening to be big. You need 5% to be big. And I think there are at least 5% of the people listening to talk radio out there who are intelligent enough to gravitate around intelligent conversation that reflects both the left and the right. If you can position yourself to do that, you'll be an industry leader and there'll be more shows like this.
Well, thank you. Yeah, from your lips to God's ears, Michael Harrison. We'll see. Michael Harrison, he's the publisher and founder of Talkers Magazine, Talkers.com. If you want to have an insight into our industry, that's the place to go. And one of the most brilliant observers of the modern scene, progressive versus reactionary. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Support group for We the People of the United States of America and all life on Earth. 21 minutes past the hour. Brad Friedman is with us, the publisher and editor of the Brad Blog, bradblog.com, the website. And Brad, you've been doing a wonderful job for many, many years on the whole election protection and election fraud issue. First of all, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom.
And a quick snapshot of how everything went on the 4th of November.
Well, we had, as usual, problems all over the country, certainly with vote purging, people showing up to their rolls, polls, finding out they were no longer on the rolls, even though they had voted recently in a primary. We saw this all over the country. I'm still getting reports of that today. And, of course, we're seeing, as usual, we saw the voting machines that just failed to start up, keeping people from voting at all. And now we've got questions in a number of states about machines that were recording votes inaccurately. And finally, these are the machines that we're relying on right now for a number of very close and questionable Senate race results in Alaska, Minnesota, Georgia, trying to gather as much detail and data as we can right now.
One of the things that, well, first of all, any sense of the numbers, Brad? My understanding is that in the 2004 election, about 3 million people had been purged from the rolls without their knowledge, showed up to vote, and were given provisional ballots. How many are, any sense of what it is this year?
It's at least 6 million is my understanding right now, maybe as high as 10 million votes cast on provisional ballots, which are often, as you know, not counted at all. And these are going to come into play, for example, in places like California, Prop 8, which would ban gay marriage in California in the Constitution. The proponents of that measure have declared victory, and yet there are still 2 to 3 million provisional and absentee vote-by-mail ballots still to be counted there.
Right, and we know in California there was a group associated with the Republican Party, the head of which was recently arrested, who flipped tens of thousands of people's voter registrations from Democrat to Republican, in many cases changed their addresses or did other things that would force them into a provisional ballot.
That's exactly right, yeah. And so that's a problem there. He was arrested. This is a problem in all of these races, including in this incredibly tight, where I think we're at about 400 something votes, this tight race between Norm Coleman and Al Franken up in Minnesota.
Right.
Now they're lucky up there to, in one extent, that they actually have paper ballots that they can go back and count, but most of the state had been counted either on these ESMS optical scanners that the week before the election, a Michigan county reported to the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission could not count the same ballots the same way twice.
Right.
So
they said it was dust causing problems, right?
What's that?
They said it was dust causing problems, that they'd run 1,000 ballots through three or four different times, and every time they come out with different numbers.
That's what they say. Now, we've seen the same problem with those OptScan systems across the country, made by not just ESMS, but Sequoia, Diebold. Diebold actually is in a number of counties up in Minnesota, two of the three largest. And their systems, their optical scan systems, also have problems.
Right, very People flaky. Brad, pardon my interrupting you, but we only have a minute left, and there's a huge story here I want to get to. Before the election, John McCain was claiming that in the last hours of November 4th, he would have a come-from-behind surge, much like George W. Bush did in the 2004 election against John Kerry. Karl Rove was predicting the same thing. And then all of a sudden, Karl Rove, a couple of days before the election, said, oops, I was wrong, there's not going to be a last-minute surge. What happened?
Well, I think that they probably realized they were overwhelmed by numbers. It's not easy, you know, when you're talking about a national election, to mess with these systems in state after state.
Do you think this had anything to do with Connell's testimony, Michael Connell?
I don't know, but you raise a good point. He was brought in, said to be one of the masterminds behind what happened in 2004 in Ohio, and he was compelled to testify on Monday. So, you know, I'd be delighted to think that that helped send out a warning that this was going to be taken seriously this time. But
yeah, there's a great article over at VelvetRevolution.us, finally an elected president, suggesting that that was the point when Michael Connell was forced to testify in court, when the order came that he was going to have to testify under oath. That was the moment when Karl Rove stopped talking about a last minute McCain pull from behind victory in the wee hours of the night.
That's right. The timing does work out exactly like that, as a matter of fact. And if that put them on notice, so be it. It also, you know, the people deserve a lot of credit here for being out there with their video cameras, putting the bad guys on notice that this time they were watching. But as I say, we still have a number of races around the country yet to be determined. And even out in Pennsylvania, by the way, I'll be running a report as soon as I get off here at bradblog.com that an entire county's touchscreen machines, 185 touchscreen machines, were ordered impounded by a judge because the straight party tickets were not showing the names of the candidates on the review screen at the end of the vote process.
Whoa. So lots of messes all over the country. We just need to get the damn corporations out of this voting business. And let's just do like the rest of the civilized world does and vote on paper and count it by hand.
Sounds good to me, Tom.
Brad Friedman, bradblog.com is website. Brad, thanks for dropping by.
Always my pleasure.
Always good talking with you, Brad. You're doing great work. Stick around. We'll be right back with Chrissy Harvey from the Center for American Progress.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Taking over. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Oh, I love that. They got the guns, but we've got the numbers, and we turned out. Chrissy Harvey with us from the Center for American Progress, the Director of Strategic Communications, AmericanProgress.org, the website. Hey, Chrissy.
Hey, Tom. I haven't talked to you since we started this whole brand new experience. How are you?
Indeed, I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Oh, exactly the same way. You know, I feel good. There's still some stuff up here in Alaska that we need to deal with. But, you know, Tuesday night was just an incredible, incredible experience.
I played for our listeners the Alaskan television interview of Sarah Palin, where she was asked about not realizing that Africa was a continent, not a country, and
yeah,
not knowing that North America, the NAFTA agreement was Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. And she made a comment about how these were just gotcha questions. It's like, oh, no.
Well, I know. And my favorite part of that interview, she was talking about going rogue. And she turned to the reporters and she said, did you guys ever hear the rumor of me going rogue? It was just me trying to slip some phone calls out to you guys, the reporters. That was my rogueness. So now that was my biggest hint that she might be looking a little bit more forward to 2012 than we even realized, you know, because she's already starting to kiss up to the media a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. She's taking a lesson from John McCain, frankly. What do you think the odds are? Last time we talked, you said Ted Stevens was, A, going to hang on to his seat, and, B, probably win. You were right on both counts. Where is this going to go? If Harry Reid says, we're not going to seat you, does there have to be another election? And if so, is it possible that Sarah Palin could resign, have her lieutenant governor take her seat as governor, and then appoint her as interim senator, and then allow her to run in that special election?
Oh, well, you know, at this point, anything is possible, honestly. Soberly and thinking about it, I would say, of course not. You know, that's crazy, but there's been so many crazy things that have happened, especially with this election and with Sarah Palin, that, you know, I really can't call this one. She was asked yesterday whether or not she thought that Senator Stevens should still resign. And Sarah Palin walked back from what she had said earlier, because earlier she was under a lot of pressure both from the McCain campaign and the national Republican scene to say, Ted, step down. Ted Stevens, you should not be doing
that. That was the official position of the McCain campaign.
Exactly. And it really angered a lot of people up here in Alaska. I told you, people in Alaska love their Uncle Ted, and people were furious. So when she realized she had to come home and face her party that was so angry with her, yesterday she walked it back and said that Alaskans had spoken, they still want him as their senator, and that we should just wait and see what happens next. So, you know, I don't know what's going to happen there. If he does win this election, I believe what's probably going to happen is he'll win this election and then he'll step down. And, you know, it's starting to look a little like that. The Republicans really just want to hang on to the seat at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And then there will be someone appointed, and then there is a special election 90 days out. I don't know. You know, I think that if she were smart, Sarah Palin would play this one straight. But as we've seen, she
by play
you know,
it straight, what do you mean?
play it straight in just appointing someone outside of her staff or herself.
But isn't this really the only chance she has for national political office? I mean, right now she is so Dan Quayle-ized.
Yes.
Nationally. And she has to redeem herself on a national stage. She can't do that as the governor of Alaska. Alaska is just too remote to make news, basically. But as a United States senator, she would have all those cameras trained on the floor of the U.S. Senate every day, many, many opportunities to become the next Ted Stevens, to become a national figure.
Well, and frankly, this is how Ted Stevens got his seat. He was appointed in a special election, so there's a little bit of precedent for that happening here.
Right.
But, you know, she also, I think, her aides should advise her. She also runs the risk of becoming the next Catherine Harris. You know, Catherine Harris wanted the big national spotlight after she helped with the 2000 election swing that towards George Bush, and she got to Washington, and she became even more of a joke than she had been in Florida. So,
right.
You know, Sarah Palin would be well advised to know that this would not be the end-all, be-all big opportunity.
But telling her that would require telling her that she's incompetent and never going to be anything bigger than she is, and I don't think anybody around her is willing to tell her that.
I don't either. Did you see the reports of how everyone drove home from the election on Tuesday night? I thought this was fascinating.
No, I missed that.
So they're at the Biltmore or wherever they were listening. I know the party was at the Biltmore, but John McCain and Sarah Palin are watching the returns. And
right.
John
Here's
McCain,
a bit of trivia, by the way, for that. They were watching the returns in the Barry Goldwater suite. Pardon my interrupting.
That's great. But when everything was said and done at the end of the night, John McCain got by himself into his Toyota Sport Utility vehicle, and he drove home. Sarah Palin left with an entourage of 18 family members, friends, hangers-on. She had a Secret Service detail. She went to the airport in a giant motorcade. It was more than a dozen vehicles. It was flanked by cops on motorcycles. It was sirens. It was hullabaloo. There were cameras. So it was very interesting, I thought, to see the principal, John McCain, say, okay, it's over, get in his car and drive home, and Sarah Palin say, the circus is just beginning.
Very, very interesting. That's an interesting analysis. Let's move beyond Sarah Palin for a moment
Sure.
here. Prop 8, the battle for gay marriage in California. I've been railing against Prop 8 for quite some time on this show, and today, again, the topic came up. And you know, the tired old Rick Santorum, you know, arguments and whatnot. But in any case, it looks like it's not inconceivable that Proposition 8 was written in such a way that it flies in the face of the California Supreme Court decision that found in the California Constitution equal protection under the law for gays and straights. Or for gays along with straights, and therefore it can be challenged on a constitutional basis.
Exactly.
Right?
This fight is far from over, and you know, it was so close in the polls that you know, it was just a real squeaker here, and activists and lawyers are now saying, you know, this is not what a ballot measure is supposed to be. A ballot measure is supposed to be a small, limited tweak to the law, and this was a constitutional revision, which is illegal. So there are now three separate and distinct lawsuits going before the courts to fight the passing of Proposition 8 and fight what the language of that measure said in the first place. So this battle's not over. It's going to keep going, and the people of California are willing to fight it.
That's good.
It is good news.
This is just a very toxic piece of legislation, and it's a terrible precedent, frankly.
It's nasty. And if you looked across the country, I was fascinated by all of the ballot measures that passed and didn't pass on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a few nasty ones that slipped in, you know, banning gay adoption in Arkansas, I thought was a particularly mean one.
Yes.
But there were so many out there that really showed that that righteous wind of change that Barack Obama has talked about really is sweeping the whole country as a whole. You know, before, in past elections, there were a lot of just mean-spirited, just nasty is the only word for it, pieces of legislation that went through as ballot measures, and this time was completely different. You know, the state of Montana, for example, passed universal health care for all kids. That's
right.
Great. Michigan decided to loosen restrictions on stem cell research. That's great. And we saw a lot of that across the country, and I thought that that was really inspirational. But Prop 8 passing was one big black eye.
Yeah, it really was, and it's, well, we'll see. We'll see how this all
shapes. We'll see. Battle's not over yet. We'll still fight.
Right. Troops in Iraq. Tell me this story about the celebrate. By the way, I got an email from somebody in Iraq, a soldier, or actually from a family member of a soldier in Iraq, who was told that he received an email that was from his commander, apparently from the command in Iraq, saying that soldiers were not allowed to celebrate the winning by Obama and are not allowed to display photographs of Barack Obama. Do you know if that's true?
I have not heard that. But that's definitely something to look into, because that's mean also. You know, that just doesn't seem to make any sense, because the president is the commander-in-chief. The president-elect will be the commander-in-chief. You would think it would be the opposite. It would be patriotic.
Well, you would think so. The point of this was that he's not yet, and therefore you're not allowed to treat him as if he is. George Bush is still the commander-in-chief, and he has to be the guy that you show deference to, blah de blah de blah. It seemed, you know, I'll forward the email to you.
Yes, I'd love that.
You can check it out and talk to this family member.
Well, we have two stories about the troops today. One was we just found out that they're going to be reducing our presence in Iraq 2 months earlier than was originally planned. This was announced this morning that we're going to bring our troops down to 14 combat brigades, and it's earlier than we were expecting to, and that's in large part because some of the violence has decreased there, but also because the troops are also needed in Afghanistan and other places like that. But it was neat. The one way the soldiers were able to celebrate the election day, 200 U.S. troops serving in Iraq were sworn in as U.S. citizens.
That's
they
great.
They hailed from 60 countries. They dressed in fatigues, and they took their citizenship oath at a ceremony at the old Saddam Palace. So that was a neat way to celebrate.
On the one hand, it's great. On the other hand, it's a shame that that's what you have to do to become a U.S. citizen these days, is put your life on the line.
Very true.
Christy Harvey, AmericanProgress.org. Thanks, Christy.
Thank you.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Tom Hartman Radio Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. For more information, go to teamster.org. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Ellen, I'm getting this report, ABC News reporting that McCain aides are furious with Palin and the people around her for scheduling her conversation with Nicolas Sarkozy, which turned out to be a hoax, that they could have prevented that from going down the way it did, and they didn't think that she should be talking to foreign heads of state anyway, number one. Number two, they're flipped out about all the money she spent on clothes. She asked McCain aides to use their personal credit cards, in one case to the tune of $40,000. There are lawyers are on the plane to Alaska today to try to track down what happened to all this money. Here's the actual quote from ABC. Lawyers for the RNC are headed to Alaska to try to account for all the money that was spent on clothing, jewelry, and luggage. What do you know?
Well, I mean, I'm hearing the same reports you are, and I have also heard, I've been around the White House most of today, that the people are not happy campers at the RNC, and of course a lot of them are putting the McCain failure onto her. I'm not sure she quite deserves it, but you know, if you don't know where that Africa is a continent, how do you teach somebody that in 6 weeks? And I remember sitting next to an editor of a major Washington publication on the way back between the two conventions. It was going from Denver to Minneapolis, and this person said to me, I don't care how well they prepare for her, she is never going to pull through the debates not knowing what she doesn't know. You just can't feed this to somebody in 6 weeks.
Yeah, she apparently never took a geography class or wasn't paying attention in fourth grade. I mean, how does a person think that Africa is a country and not a continent?
I don't know, but you got the year right, because it's fourth grade is actually when I remember my best friend in school and I made a map. We had to do maps of the continents, and I made a map with my best friend of South America.
Oh, cool.
I mean, and it was exactly in Miss Turner's fourth grade. So I don't know how she missed it, but boy, that's a big miss.
That's great. So what else is going on in the world? We know Rahm Emanuel is the chief of staff.
Rahm Emanuel is chief of staff, and that, of course, has also made for some other interesting things in the House. There is a Waxman-Dingell fight about House energy. Nancy Pelosi is very much clearly behind the scenes pushing Waxman, and he's been public about it, so a lot of people think he's got the votes to do it. Of course, Dingell ran into trouble with the Pelosi folks because of his big ties to the auto companies. And
you know, it's because John Dingell represents Detroit, basically. I mean, he's from Michigan, from southeastern Michigan.
That's right.
Yeah. And his wife was very involved in something, as I recall. I'm forgetting what it was. This was about a year ago.
Debbie Dingell. I think she does lobbying or party plan. I can't remember, but she's sort of a behind-the-scenes active person here in Washington, D.C.
Yep.
So that's sort of one fight that's going on. And then Roy Blunt says that he's not going for the whip position. So now they're looking at Eric Cantor, sort of a new congressman, very conservative Jewish congressman, looking at him at the whip position on the Republican side.
Interesting.
So that's another sort of sea change. And speaking of sea changes, Tom Donahue, who's U.S. Chamber of Commerce, he runs the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, he's saying they now want to work directly with Barack Obama, that they want to, you know, sort of mend the fence and work in a way with the White House for the good of America. So that's interesting.
Yeah, for our listeners who don't know the backstory on that, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was the major funder, or one of the major funders, and continues to be, actually, for the anti-card check legislation, the anti-union legislation, the Employee
right.
Free Choice Act. And they use that to beat up particularly progressive, but just generally Democratic candidates all over the United States. Here in Oregon, they went after Jeff Merkley with just relentless TV ads. They did the same thing, as I understand, all across the United States in these individual Senate races and House races, and they went after Barack Obama as well.
Well, why are we not surprised? It is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Also, President-elect Obama will be going to the White House on Monday. President Bush today, I was on the South Lawn today, had a very brief sort of statement with all of his cabinet members with his, on the South Lawn to employees of the White House, everybody from the bakers to the people who really make policy, talking about the transition. And the one thing I have to say is, so far, from my observations, the White House is actually extending the old olive branch, and they really are doing a good job on the transition and trying to make it easy for President-elect Obama.
That's interesting. Do you think that they're doing that in hopes that he will not prosecute them for crimes?
Maybe. I think President Bush is looking at his next 75 days and saying, I have to have some legacy, and I don't want it to be, you know, sort of the Grinch that stole the new presidency.
Yeah.
And so I think they're actually trying to deal with that. Now, as you know, there's unemployment figures that will be seen, and they expect them to go up. And so that is going on. Also, the White House is working on the strategic framework on the status of forces, and they have given to Iraq back their viewpoint, so we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. 74 days, 8 hours, 34 minutes, 21 seconds until Barack Obama is sworn in and the long national nightmare is over. So
we'll all be sleeping.
Yes, we will all finally be able to rest. I didn't realize how tense I had been for the last 8 years until that.
No, when President Clinton became president, I got my first night's sleep in 12 years, I swear.
I absolutely agree with you, Ellen. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Have a great one. Coming up tomorrow, of course, it's Friday, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders will be dropping by to take your calls. You get to ask a United States senator pretty much anything you want right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, my friends, no matter what happens in the elections, there's still a lot out there. Democracy depends on you. Activism depends on you. It's ours. It's our work to do. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.